And Dr. Buller is a sociologist who is currently at Clark Atlanta University. Texas Southern University. See, I don't have my glasses on. So I was told that change was coming, but I didn't know it was finalized. So
It's finalized now.
So Texas Southern University. Dr. Buller is a pioneer in the field of environmental justice. Among his many accomplishments, Dr. Buller helped to organize the 1991 National People of Color Environmental Leadership Summit, the first meeting of this kind where various groups of color came together to talk about environmental justice. He was very instrumental in the executive order on environmental justice. He has written many books. Is it 15 books, 16 books now? 17 books related to the topic of environmental justice, including the class of Dumping and Dixie, Race, Class, and Environmental Equality, Confronting Environmental Racism, and a really important book recently on race, place, and environmental justice after Hurricane Katrina. And he actually has a really good book on equity as well, and planning and environmental justice is really important. So Dr. Buller is really one of the leading authorities on how to kind of address built environment and really understand those driving sort of issues that lead to disparities and some of the approaches that are being used by community leaders, by grassroots organizers to address environmental justice. So he will give his vision for the future and talk about the accomplishments in the field and ways that we can move forward and really address emerging and future challenges in this field. Dr. Buller.
Thank you very much. Good morning. I'm a sociologist by training, and I'm an environmental sociologist. And I'm really proud to say that I am an environmentalist. I got my start in Houston way back in 1976. And I moved back to Houston 2 weeks ago to become the dean of the Barbara Jordan Mickey Leland School of Public Affairs at Texas Southern University. Thank you. I've come full circle. My talk will, looking at the role of environmental justice movement in advancing public health, past, present, and future. As a sociologist, what I'm trying to do over the last 30 years plus is to connect the dots. And these are some of the books that I've written. Deal with housing, transportation, land use, industrial facility siting, climate, smart growth, equitable development, health. It's a bunch of books, 17, but it's only one book, and the key is health. And health is more than the absence of disease. You can't have a healthy community if you have an overabundance of pollution, if you have people, if you have health disparities, if you have a community that's overrun with drugs, if you have a community that has lack of access, as Angela said, to basic services that people in many communities of color, in low-income communities, call them amenities. Having a grocery store as an amenity, having access to health care and a clinic as an amenity, a drugstore, transit, amenity. Most people take it for granted and say that's a basic service. You take it for granted. And so when we talk about this whole issue of how the environmental justice movement redefined environment, the environment is not something that's just out there. The environment is in this room. The environment is everything. It's where we live, work, play, worship, learn, as well as the physical and natural world. That doesn't leave a whole lot out. And so when we talk about the principle of environmental justice, the principle of environmental justice embraces this idea that all communities are entitled to equal access and equal protection of our environmental laws, our health laws, housing, transportation, our civil rights laws. And so what we have transportation, what we've tried to do over the last three decades plus is to merge those issues of sustainability, of human rights, and health. And so this is not new. You're talking about the environment section being 100 years old. Well, there are some of us that have been involved in about 30 years. I haven't been around 100. But going back to 1968, for example, Dr. Martin Luther King went to Memphis, Tennessee to deal with an environmental, health, civil rights, justice, human rights issue, striking garbage workers. It was about the question of basic rights. And so when we talk about this issue, how I got involved in 1978, 10 years after the garbage strike, drafted into this idea of what happens to your garbage? Well, when you bag it or can it or recycle, it doesn't go to garbage heaven. It goes somewhere. That somewhere is either landfill, generally, or an incinerator. And so, in 1978, I was in Houston. I was a young assistant, untenured professor at Texas Southern University, the university where I have returned. And my wife asked me to collect data for this lawsuit that she had filed against. Now, I worked for a state university. I was a state employee to be an expert witness on a case she had filed the state of Texas, lawsuit against the state of Texas. She sued my employer. And so against this company, which was headquartered in Houston. I won't call any names, but the initials are BFI. This company was proposing to place, site, a sanitary landfill, and we know there's nothing sanitary about a garbage dump, in the middle of this predominantly black community in Houston. When I say predominantly black, that's like me saying my family is predominantly black. This was an all-black community in northeast Houston. And so I said, she wanted me to collect data for this lawsuit, and she said, well, Bob, they're trying to put this landfill in the middle of this predominantly black, middle-class, suburban neighborhood. 85% of the people own their homes. There's nothing out there but trees, housing, and black people. This was not a ghetto. It was not a poverty pocket. This was a black middle-class community. So the only thing that separated them out was race. And so I said, you need a sociologist to collect data for that lawsuit to be your expert witness. She said, that's what you are, right? That's how I got involved. That's how I collected data for this study in 1979. That's how I've been involved since. And so when we talk about this whole question of where people live and place and race matters, this landfill was called Whispering Pines. Sanitary landfill. And so when we talk about the issue of residential apartheid, where you live can impact your quality of life, your zip code being a major indicator of health, who gets what, when, where, and why. Houston is the fourth largest city in the country. It's the only major city to this day that does not have zoning. It has what's called unrestrained capitalism, meaning if you have the money, you can put anything, anywhere, anytime. And so when we talk about this whole question of, I wrote this book called Invisible Houston, and this is the first book I wrote, and it looks at what happened in Houston in terms of Houston having the largest black community in the South, over 500,000 black people in the South at that time, and the fact that all the landfills, 5 out of 5 of the city-owned landfills located in black communities in Houston, 3 out of 4 of the privately owned landfills, 6 out of 8 of the incinerators located in black neighborhoods. 82% of all the waste being dumped in Houston was dumped in black communities. Blacks only made up 25% of the population. We developed, designed a protocol for doing analysis on this particular case. The fact that there were no sidewalks, there was garbage trucks running up and down the streets, people getting killed, people, most likely children, getting hit by trucks. And so when we talk about the fact that garbage landfills attract garbage, we don't know why scientifically. So when we talk about this whole issue, before that was a movement, you know, I did the study, but Warren County brought it home. I'm giving you 30 years plus history of EJ and how EJ has always been about health. It's always been about equity. It's always been about justice and fairness and changing policy so that all communities have equal access to the good stuff and not more than their fair share of the bad stuff. I've been to every state in this country. I've traveled across many communities, and I have never seen a low-income community of color that has more than its fair share of libraries, parks, good schools. I'm really going to tell it because I have tenure, and I'm a dean now. So when we talk about Warren County raising this whole national scene that this community said no to this toxic waste dumping, and United Church of Christ, Charles Lee, sitting in the audience, one of the authors of the United Church of Christ, showed a national scene that race is the most potent predictor of where these hazardous waste facilities are located. This study was done by not by university or not by the government, but a church-based civil rights organization, understanding that when a lot of times we can't wait for the government to take action. We have to take action ourselves. Non-governmental organizations, community-based organizations, and other kinds of groups. So when we talk about this, let me back up. Warren County. These are young people who have put their bodies in harm's way trying to stop dump trucks from dumping PCB-laced dirt, contaminated dirt in their neighborhood. This is a great photograph. I said, that's such a great photograph. That's such a great photograph. Oops, going the wrong way. Yeah, that's such a great photograph. That should be on the book. And so I wrote Dumping in Dixie in 1990, and that was the first book on environmental justice. And I wrote it, I didn't write it as a textbook, but Westview Press made it a textbook, and my royalty checks were fat with a P. A lot of schools adopted it as a textbook, and I said, you know, I wrote a book to get, you know, 160 pages to get in the hands of people so that policy and organizing and networking, we can make some change. What we found out is that when we decide for ourselves that we're not going to allow other people to make decisions for us, that's when things started to change. When we basically said that no community should become the dumping grounds, no community should basically be a toxic wasteland. In 1991, we organized the first National People of Color Environmental Leadership Summit, and to say we speak for ourselves. And how did that paradigm shift change? Is because of growing grassroots activism. We redefined what environmentalism is. We had our conferences, our workshops. We had more and more people in academia saying, okay, we need to work with our communities and let communities drive our research. This was long before community-based participatory research was actually given a title. And the whole focus was environmental justice is driven by health. It's all about health. And so when we talk about those principles, first principle of environmental justice, that people most impacted must speak for themselves. We updated the 1987 Toxic Waste and Race report in 20 years later, and we found that basically things had gotten worse in terms of where these facilities are and who lives next door. In 2007, we found that 56% of the residents live within a 2-mile radius of these hazardous waste facilities were people of color. When you add two or more, the clustering, that number jumps to 69%. And so when everybody does not have the same access living next to a facility or having a hazardous waste facility as a, quote, good neighbor, if you are poor and if you are people of color, you get more than your fair share. And so when we talk about this whole question of how we apply and what lenses we use health, we use equity. There's more than 200 studies that now, environmental studies, that show there are racial and ethnic disparities. And so when we talk about how did our movement get this far and how did we start to actually get recognition? For a long time, people would just poo-poo us. Well, that's the EJ people, whatever. But now our groups, our leaders are winning national and international awards. They're winning Goldman Prizes and Heinz Awards and MacArthur's, and they win in all kinds of awards now for their work. Ordinary people that are doing extraordinary work. And so when we talk about government response, long before Hurricane Katrina devastated the Gulf Coast, African Americans and other people of color knew all along, and they learned the hard way. When you wait for the government, oftentimes that can be hazardous to your health. And so when we talk about this whole issue of how government responded. 1994, President Clinton signed the executive order. Many of us went to that room, went to the Oval Office. In February, it was snowing, it was cold. Nice office. What has been the state's response? States are responding. In 1993, there was only one state. New Hampshire was the first state to pass an environmental justice law. In 2011, as I stand here, all states have, right now, all 50 states have an environmental justice law or an executive order dealing with environmental justice. Now, they all different because all states are not created equal. There are some that are more equal than others. California is different from Mississippi, some people would say. And so when we talk about the government responding, Institute of Medicine, 1999, did their study on environmental justice. Very smart people. And they basically came up with this whole idea that some people of color in low-income communities are exposed to higher levels of pollution. Yeah. But we needed IOM to say that. There's some of us have been saying this for, you know, a while, but we need very smart people to say it. And so we know place matters, and we know that race matters, as was stated earlier. And so when we talk about healthy people and healthy places being correlated, the most unhealthiest or the unhealthiest places oftentimes include a disproportionate number of poor people and people of color. And we talk about zip codes, special communities at risk. Associated Press did a study in 2005 showed that 79% of African Americans, that African Americans are more than 79% more likely to live in neighborhoods that pose the greatest environmental health risk than whites. And that's 19 states for black people, 12 states for Hispanics, and 7 states for Asians. This is not a poverty thing. Even middle-income African-Americans' families make $50,000 or more likely to be living in polluted neighborhoods than whites who make $10,000. So when we talk about Cosby family, yes, Cosby family oftentimes also live in areas, neighborhoods, where there is a disproportionate share of negative externalities. Here's a case I'm going to run through quickly. Here's a case in Tennessee right now that I'm working on as one of the advisors on the case. This is a case of black families on land for 7 generations, 150 acres of land. It wasn't no 40 acres in Mule. They got 150 acres of land, and they've been living there on that land. Their land is poisoned with TCE by a landfill that's 54 feet from their neighborhood, I mean from their farm. And the government tested duck ponds, dog pounds water, but would not test this family's water. You understand their family is sick. There's a lawsuit going on right now. It's been in Ebony. Ebony. We want it to be in Ebony. It's been in Time Magazine, People's Magazine, New York Times, Washington Post, CNN, Tavis Smiley, Tom Joyner. All those folks have covered it. But the fact is, they're still trying to get justice. We know that air pollution is not randomly distributed. People of color more likely to live in areas where there's lots of pollution. We know that when we basically clean up the air, as was done in, you know, we couldn't drive our cars and during the 96 Olympics in Atlanta, we know the air got cleaner. There were fewer asthma attacks, fewer people going, kids going to the hospital. We know that when we clean up our air, it extends the lifespan on average, you know, 6 months. You know, at 63, I don't know about you 20-something folks out there, but 6 months, I want my 6 months. And so when we talk about dirty air, we talk about the problems of being hooked on coal. There's no clean coal, Mr. President. It's a myth. It's oxymoronic. It's a fantasy. It's like saying giant shrimp. And so we talk about coal plants, and we know where they are. We know the benefits of cleaning up the coal and going to renewables. We know the health effects. The health benefits, I should say. We know the most impacted, the most vulnerable are children, mercury coming out, the smokestacks, lead, heavy metals. We know who are most likely to be impacted. And so when we talk about excess deaths, we talk about health effects, we map where the pollution is, and we map who lives where. So this is not rocket science. We know impacts of dirty air and asthma, rising race, epidemic proportions. And so when we talk about schools, even children are not safe. Facilities located next to schools, fence line. We know about 6 schools. We know what we could do if we would retrofit our schools, make them green schools, cleaning up health benefits as well as education benefits. And so when we talk about these issues of living next to power plants, we talk about outdoor apartheid. Parks. We know parks value are parks. We want our kids to romp and play outside. We're not talking about making everybody a marathon runner, but at least get them off the couch. And so all parks are not created equal. So many of our parks are located fence line with some of the most dangerous plants, chemical plants in the country. This is not trick photography. This is Louisiana, Cancer Alley. And so I think what we should say is, I'm wrapping up, because I saw the flash. challenges and opportunities. All these issues are converging that deal with smart growth, sustainability, that deal with the whole issue of how can we create a green economy so that it's not only green, but it's also fair and just, so that access and opportunity become the driver. And Angela gave you those demographics that we can't wait to 2042. We should not be waiting for 2050 for that light bulb to go on. We need to start right now to address these issues. And so I think ultimately we have to understand that if we are to become a just and healthy and sustainable society, we must address those legacy issues that have been so hard to unravel, unpack, and address, and deal with. Those legacy issues deal with justice, fairness, and equity. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Dr. Bullitt.